Our political commentators, Neil Jones was Chief of Staff to Labor leader Jacinda Ardern and before that to Andrew Little. He's the Director of Capital Government Relations in Wellington. Trish Sherson is with corporate affairs firm Sherson Willetts and is a former ACT Party Press Secretary. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Well, just with the Prime Minister's indication this morning that the shift or the consideration of whether to shift levels is coming forward a fortnight from June 22nd to June 8th, there's been a lot of pressure building, obviously, as the number of cases has got back to just one active case, 10 days with no new cases. Still, the epidemiologists warn you need to leave a buffer, but really, is there much choice, Neil, do you think, at the moment, given the stresses and pressure that business is under?
Yeah, I think it is a really hard one politically for the government. The health advice is very clear, as you point out. You want at least two cycles in the clear with no cases, so that's 4 weeks. And that takes you to about June 22nd, which is when the government indicated it would review level two to level one by at the latest. I think the issue they will face is it's not just a matter of the health advice. They have to weigh up public tolerance for the restrictions because buy-in is absolutely crucial. And I think this just goes back to our human nature, which is we are, as a species, very good at dealing with immediate threats. But as these threats recede into the distance, we seem to get a bit blasé about them. And we see that, you know, in the climate change debate, for example. So I think when you take the fact we have one active case that we know of and the ongoing, you know, economic pressures. And then when you take, for example, the mass gathering in Auckland yesterday of 4,000 people, I think the social licence becomes very frayed and it becomes hard for the government to maintain those restrictions.
Trish.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what it really frames up again is that that debate about how well I think we're doing in comparison to Australia, because there's that talk there about, you know, looking after the co-well-being, meaning that the health and the economy, and trying now to make sure that they're back on track. I thought over the weekend, actually, there's two things. Number one, obviously you had Winston Peters. This has just been absolutely gold for him, riding into this this debate about looking after business and getting the restrictions down, and he laid into it again at the weekend, and you know, that's then framed up as putting pressure on the government. But I think the bigger point for me is if you go around New Zealand now, and restaurants are a great example where they are still having to work at below sort of half mast, their costs are up, but their customers are down because of these restrictions, it's really hard, I think, to argue that you can continue to keep those businesses under that kind of pressure. And I think the signalling today from the Prime Minister that they're going to be open and a bit more agile around this and look to get the restrictions off next week, I think that's a good thing, and I actually think it has to happen. But I think just on the back on the point about Peters, I thought his comments were actually a bit silly around the fact that, you know, the police should have been arresting people and riding in. You know, for a pro test like that, that would have been like a match to a tinderbox. And I thought the police handled it in exactly the right way, just to you know, to keep things calm, let people do their thing.
I am also still asking questions, as are others, Neil, about the readiness for the future. And this, this is the thing. We were told that elimination wouldn't mean you never have another case. In fact, count on having another case or another outbreak. And yet, we're at this point with one last case where we have to do this, you know, the 2 weeks, the two cycles all the way through. It straight away raises a question. What happens in the future when we do have another case? Or cases, what's going to be the response between, is there going to be a movement back through levels? These are all, in the uncertainty that we accept, these are all indications the government is going to have to give as it makes this transition as well, because this is information, as best it can be given, that people need to plan.
Yeah, and I mean, the hope is that on the other side of this, we will have much better contact tracing and testing. I think part of what probably put us into lockdown so rapidly, you know, a couple of months ago, was that we simply didn't have the testing and contact tracing capability in New Zealand to handle these cases, so we had to lock down. The hope is that if we do get new cases emerging, and even if we think we've wiped it out, borders are more porous than we like to think, it's not a drawbridge, then we can hopefully manage to isolate and manage those cases without having to go into a heavy lockdown. I think though it does make sense. I mean, I personally would err on the side of caution. I think it does make sense to try and properly eliminate the virus and to go through the full 28 days. If we were really cautious, we would restart the clock today after yesterday's protest. But I think, as we've noted, it's not going to be possible politically for the government to do that. And I think we're probably going to be back into level one by about Wednesday next week.
Trish, also, it's not only the social licence, it's also the habits that people have got into that you actually want them to sustain, whether it's a natural distancing wherever possible and not spending long amounts of time around around people you don't know if it's not necessary, whether it's the hygiene practices. The more things begin to creak around the seams or people start to question why they, why the higher levels are in place, the greater the risk that we let go of those habits in some ways.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting this morning, the Prime Minister's new languaging around this. She's now talking about the new normal, quote, with COVID in the world. And that's exactly to your point, Catherine. What she's signalling is we have to try and get back to a normal life, but we have to recognise that the threat is still out there. And that's both, as we go about our everyday lives in New Zealand, potentially, and also, as Neil pointed out, around how we tightly manage our borders. But, you know, there's been quite a few interesting pieces written about, you know, the second wave globally, if that happens, how governments would need to respond. And most of the writing that I have seen is saying, you know, a return to those kind of mass lockdowns is just not feasible because you wouldn't, governments just wouldn't have the social license to do it, and the damage for the economy wouldn't be too great. So the thinking is, if that did happen next time around, and potentially this is what the government is considering, is how would you have your testing systems up to scratch, but you would also be able to implement smaller, more localised responses in terms of moving up or down levels that would in the main keep most people and most of the economy working normally, but you would be able to contain and manage those breakouts.
It is a big question mark remaining, and when, you know, the leading epidemiologists say we are still not seeing the data that we as researchers need to see to give you the good advice, right? And when we saw the latest results out of the contact tracing for, I'm just trying to think what the period was, it was the second sort of tranche through to mid-April, I think, slipping back to 9 days when the target is more like 3 or 4. You know, at what cost? What limit would you put on investing in whatever goddamn system you need? You know, this is the thing. What is the gap? What is the holdup on getting the system we need?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah. Oh, you go, Trish.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's because everybody is guessing, right? No one knows exactly what the perfect solution here is, and that's the part of the issue all the way through. But also the bigger worry is, And can you imagine the blowback if we've all gone through all of this and then we find, because essentially what New Zealanders were asked to do in going to level four was to give our health authorities and our health systems time to prepare and to kind of and catch up and make sure that they were ready. And then we went down the elimination path. Imagine the blowback from New Zealanders if we said, look, we've done all that for you, but you, the health system, haven't managed to get yourself up to scratch or to be able to protect us. Because I come back to the words, and I think it was John Armstrong actually writing a couple of weeks ago, and his words were that we haven't even reached base camp in the fight against COVID-19. And I think that's the one thing that we need to keep coming back to. We've won a tiny sort of initial skirmish in what could be a massive and ongoing war, and we don't know how that's going to turn up. Medical experts don't know how this virus could potentially evolve in 6 months or a year. We don't know whether we'll have a vaccine or not. So there are just so many unknowns that we're dealing with here. And I think we have to be, or everybody has to be prepared that this this will be ongoing for quite some time. Yeah.
Again, though, when you hear the references again from Nick Wilson of Otago University to Taiwan's success without even a lockdown, and we know South Korea has had its wins and its losses, and the plea again to learn from what they have done. They learnt their lesson back when SARS happened, right? I guess the point I'm making is the billions, that is the impact of this on our economy. What price do you put on doing whatever you have to do, even if it's 5,000 contact traces, as Motu's John McDermott suggested back at one of the early interviews I did with him, and he based it on about 0.1% of the population and had been looking at what had been happening in Asian countries. If you were stuck with manual tracing, right, just people doing whatever they've got to do to hunt people down, he thought it might be 5,000 to go across a population of 5 million, and this was anticipating a big outbreak. Just whatever it takes and whatever it costs, surely, Neil?
Yes, that would make sense. And I think not just for COVID-19, but one thing that this has showed is that we and many other countries have not been prepared for pandemics in general. This will not be the last pandemic we see. And if you look at the countries that have done well, that were prepared with contact tracing and testing at the start of the outbreak, it was countries in Asia who had had experience with SARS and other diseases and had the systems in place, and our Ministry of Health was not prepared. And so I just agree. We're spending billions and billions on the economy right now. We should probably invest a bit of money, and there has been a bit of money going to the health system, into making sure we're prepared. Another point I think we should make as well, before we get off this topic, is it's easy to forget that, you know, while we are chafing a bit under level two for some reason, We actually have far fewer restrictions in New Zealand than most other countries now. And I think that's worth remembering, that for countries that haven't locked down as hard and haven't taken as strong action, they are currently under far more restrictions. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that Australia was being held up as the model for New Zealand to follow. They still have new active cases. They still have more restrictions than us. There are still restrictions for travel between states. So I think it's also worth just recognising that things in New Zealand aren't quite so bad as we think.
Well, it depends, I guess, on whether it's your business gone, your job gone, your community in many ways. And this is the difficult thing, Trish, politically. There are two New Zealands at the moment. There are New Zealanders absolutely being smashed by this, and there are others going, oh, we're fine working from home. We don't, you know, we hear from them. We don't need to come back to the office to help our central cities businesses. Maybe actually one gesture as an economic stimulus might be the public service getting back to support those businesses if it is safe, and that being something the government thinks about as an immediate injection to businesses running at 30 or 50% of their normal clientele. The other thing I really wanted to point out, it was interesting just hearing from Oxford University overnight, their government response tracker is now going beyond the health measures to cover economic measures as well, Trish. And I'm wondering if there is, I know Treasury is putting out some real-time economic impact data that mainly economists can make sense of, but is this something that needs to be brought alongside, not to compete with the health obligations, but for everybody to appreciate the extent of what we're in?
Yeah, and let's not forget this. I think that's an excellent point. So there's two parts to that. Let's have a look at getting the public service back into the central city, because it's not just about the economic stimulus. It's about showing that's now okay, right? But there's a big practical issue, and I know there's been a lot of companies here in Auckland, and they are not coming back to town in level two, or they are on a kind of a two-team system where you have a team in the office 1 week and a team working from home. But a big part of that is just just a practical thing. If you're in a big high-rise building under these level two restrictions, you have a very limited number of people who you can get in the lift, right? So if you had everyone back in those buildings, it could take you all day just to get up to your office, let alone get back down. So you've got to have the restrictions gone in order for the practical, you know, the practicalities of getting back to working life to be okay. But on your second point, which I think is also a really important one, you know, we are seeing now this blowback around the additional payment the government announced last week. I think it's up to $490 for people who lost their jobs during COVID. You can see why there was a lot of unhappiness about that last week, not just from existing beneficiaries, but think about all of those in the tourism sector who had lost their job, you know, probably December to March before we all went into lockdown, and they're saying, well, what about my payment? But the bigger question there is, you know, we have become used to as a country a very simple health indicator to show how we were going in order to beat COVID. And to your point, we now need to put alongside that how we are tracking economically in a simple form that everyone apart from economists can, you know, as well as economists can understand, because we all now have a role to play in being able to get back on track. And if you think about what those kind of numbers would need to be, obviously, you know, unemployment is going to be key, but the other ones are also how we're then going to track against the debt to GDP ratio, because that's, you know, we've got to over time know how we are going to bring that down. So I think that is a really good initiative. I don't know that it's one that this government will sign up to, but that, you know, if you were in opposition right now, that is absolutely something that you would be framing up and thinking about rolling out.
Yeah, look, the two-tier management, the flexibility of home and away, don't misinterpret me, that's going to be part of our lives for months, if not years to come, right? It's more the attitude that we're fine. The point is many, many small businesses are not fine. They're not going to make it. They need to know whether they've got a chance of making it or not. And the delays do impact on them. So that's what I'm getting to, rather than we should be riding roughshod over sensible strategies. Neil, just on the question of the economic health indicators, 75% in that Commission for Financial Capability Survey, 75% of households are either already in financial difficulty or at risk of falling into it when the wage subsidy ends. That's the kind of economic health data that needs to be under scrutiny.
Yes, and I think that there is, you know, it would be good to see more of that released and more context to the public. I think we are not quite aware yet of how bad this is going to get. I think Todd Muller, he overreached last week when he said most workers are unemployed, they just don't know it yet. But I think there is something to be said about there is a looming crisis that we're not quite seeing yet. I was talking to someone in the weekend I know who runs a SME, and he was saying to me, you know, we were running at about 15% under level three. We're now at about 30%, and we're going to struggle to keep all our people. And I think there are a lot of businesses right now that are just teetering on unemployment. And I think that gets back to that two-tier benefit system, which I think, you know, if you look at it as a 12-week redundancy paid by the state, makes a lot of sense. But I think it just, again, goes to the point that we don't have the social support we're going to need to support people long-term in unemployment and to support people who are already in unemployment. I think also we need to be very clear on whether there is enough stimulus going in to support a lot of those small businesses. We've got the shovel-ready projects coming, we've got money being pumped into the economy, and we've got the extension of the wage subsidy, but there may be a call for some kind of stimulus, even if it's cash payments to people's pockets, to get people spending money in those small businesses to tide them over for now.
Can we be clear that two-tier system, are you saying it's temporary, the higher payment for those affected by COVID?
Yeah, it's a 12-week right. payment.
Let's talk about National then, and the week that was for the first week of a new leader, some typical gaffes, etc., that probably the Beltway focuses on more than others. But Trish, what did you make of it?
Well, probably underwhelming at best. It just seemed that there was a lack of preparation. So, okay, did pretty well day one. I think we talked about last week. Todd did pretty well day one, and his speech was okay when he won the leadership. But then last week, you literally just went from one shocker to the next. Whether it was the mismanagement outside the National Party caucus room, which resulted in the TV3 story that night, which was one of the probably worst pieces of political management I've seen in a long time. And then you also had Muller. You know, if you think about when you become leader first, you have a series of those first round interviews. I heard him with you last week, Catherine, and he also did, obviously, other major media, and just failed to fire to the extent where you had, key sort of National Party, media supporters who were not only underwhelmed but a little bit dismayed at how that had all got off track. I just wondered also too, and I know, you could pass this off as sort of nothing, but the inability to handle that question outside the caucus room, which everybody knew was obviously going to come after the National Party reshuffle, about how many Māori MPs are now in your shadow cabinet. It's one of those classic questions, isn't it, in politics, that can either absolutely quickly define you as a leader, because you have an ability just to shut it down and to move on, or it has the ability to raise questions about how good you're going to be, because the party got absolutely mired in that for the next sort of 48 hours. So if I were National, I wouldn't be particularly happy at how week one went, and you'd need to be working on something pretty good to try and get things on track.
Neil.
Yeah, I agree with Trish. It was astoundingly poor political management. The thing about being a new leader of the opposition is you only really get one chance to introduce yourself to voters, and it's very hard to turn that around, especially if you only have a few months. And the first job really is to define yourself. And I think after that first press conference, Muller didn't really have a plan. And that means his brand has been defined for him, which means a lot of people watching him will see him and think he's a bit useless, he's a bit racist, and he's vague on the economy. And that's probably unfair. I think it's almost certainly unfair. But that's the scrutiny and pressure you face when you're leader of the opposition. And so, you have to ask why he and his advisors thought it was a good idea to get into an argument about whether a hat is racist. Why they thought, not to look. And I've been involved in putting reshuffles together. The first time you find out that you have no Māori in your top 12 should not be when the media are asking you about it, and it certainly shouldn't be when your deputy is standing next to you claiming Paul Goldsmith's Ngāti Porou. I think that he also, he went in there saying he was the big economy guy who was going to fix the economy, and that was a sensible way to do it. It is National's only really viable path to victory. But as I noted last week on this slot, he can't go and say that and then have nothing intelligent when he's asked about what his plans are. So he spent the week flailing his arms, umming and ahhing about what he'd actually do. And it wasn't till, late Friday afternoon, before a long weekend, they kind of rushed out a policy so he had something to talk about. I just think, he's defined himself negatively, and he's also damaged himself on his key positive.
It was a classic example of this is not as easy as it looks, wasn't it?
I know you very well. It worked for three opposition leaders.
But the point is, with 4 months to go, and this was the point I kept making in the interview, with 4 months to go, you've got to come ready to go. You can't come up with a slogan repeated over and over again that we're National and we're just better at this stuff. You can't say, I'm going to take time to think about stuff. You've either thought about it and you're ready to go, and boy, you've got a short amount of time, as you two point out, a short amount of time to create that impression on people. I do think ears will be open, Trish. I do think people who are more naturally inclined towards National will be checking him out in a way they had apparently switched out with respect to his predecessor. But you get a limited window for that.
Yeah, you do. And also don't forget, like, you know, you've got, you've got a group of core National Party supporters who absolutely their ears will be open. But you've also got that big soft centre that you need to lure back from Labour. And you've got to say something that's going to prick up their ears and break through their inertia. Because looking at last week, you might have sort of almost, you know, seen it as a bit of a sideshow and then pretty much switched off. So I think that is the bigger job, right, to really now have some discipline, have some clarity, have some good messaging that people can rally around. And you know, it's amazing to think that if you can't do that right now, when we're in the current situation that we've just spent this morning talking about, as an opposition, there is just so much for them to hone in on and to really shape themselves up as a great opposition in Parliament and then head out on the hustings. So, you know, there's so much material they've got to work with.
Neil, I am curious, for you having observed more leadership transitions probably than you'd have liked, when the slogans ran out, when the talking points ran out, he was in trouble. And really the test of any leader or any politician is whether you can speak for yourself. Okay, everyone has their messaging and their core message and everyone focus groups and works and everyone can spot it a mile off, frankly. But when it comes to getting beyond those statements, you really find out whether someone has got something to say. And again, you've got to give someone, I guess, a week, but they don't get too much longer to begin to demonstrate that.
Yeah, and it is remarkable that people can get themselves elected to be leader of a political party and they're not quite be sure why they're there. I think you're right. You need to, at your core, be able to explain to the public, this is who I am, this is what drives me, and this is what I want to achieve. And if you can do that, you're a long way there. Jacinda Ardern managed to do that very well. I think, though, you do need to have that policy background. You do need to be prepared, and I think you do need to be able to speak coherently. And I think part of what Mullet did was he rested too heavily on the National Party brand. I think he thought, you know, we're still the party of key in English. We can just ride this out and say we're the economy people. And his problem was people didn't believe him. They wanted detail. And I think that is a hard lesson for him. And I think it's done him damage. And he's going to have to get some policy pretty quickly.
Thank you both very much, Trish Shearson and Neil Jones.